welcome, boys and girls. Good to be back with you again. I'm Henrik, and this is Red Eyes Radio. We are back after the Ameren Conference in Tennessee just this past weekend. And it was hard, for sure. We were vastly undermanned and a lot of work for not that much output, unfortunately. It was a bit disappointing with the connection issues that we had, to be honest. We were out in a state park, for those of you who don't know, and it was very sporadic internet connection, especially late on the Saturday evening. We had plans to head out of the conference center to a couple of cabins where there was an after party, and we couldn't get a stable connection at all. So it was a bit stressful and difficult to pull everything together on such short notice. Plus, there was also a lot of people that didn't want to be on camera. And so, you know, we just couldn't film where we wanted or who we wanted. So we should have been better prepared for that. Maybe I brought some masks or something, disguises. But hey, at least we did it. I've not heard of anyone as of yet that has done live streaming video from Ameren or any other conference of this kind. So we definitely beat them to it. So at least that's something. We'll do it much better next time. We've learned a lot. We'll have some more people with us and some more time to prepare and set up in time as well. You can still watch the three segments that we did live stream. They are on our YouTube channel. We'll also upload them to redeyes.tv and redeyesmembers.com here soon. Our guest today is Nathan Danigo, who also did show up at the conference. We shot this one about 2 days before we took off for Ameren. We're doing this one as video for our members, so if you want to see this one, definitely check out the memberships that we have at redeyesmembers.com, and you can tune into all our previous shows there, both ours and also a selection of shows that we are starting to do as video for members from now on. Nathan Danigo is a combat veteran of the Iraq War, currently studying for an undergraduate degree in social science at the University of California, Stanislaus. In March 2016, he created Identity Europa, a North American-based identitarian organization dedicated to creating a new future for people of European heritage. His work has been published in Radix Journal, and activities as a blogger have been reported by Time Magazine. Hi, Nathan. Good to see you again. It's good to have you back on the show. Well, have you back. It's actually the first time you're on the show, but we, of course, did the Berkeley thing together, so it's good to finally have you here.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate you having me on. I'm really excited.
Very good. Well, before we talk about your latest endeavor of the, you know, Identity Europa, tell us how you ended up connecting with the National Youth Front and kind of what led you to where you are today.
Well, goodness, it's a really long story, but I think I'll start with, I guess, National Youth Front. And that was, goodness, almost about 2 years ago. And I think I remember at that time just looking over and seeing what was happening in Europe and seeing Generation Identitaire was really just getting their start at that point. And I was seeing a lot of other groups that were starting to form and really manage to push back against what was going on. And so I just got really excited, and I thought to myself, like, this is the way we can move forward to get our ideas out. I think that the internet and social media has definitely made it possible for just a very small group of people to have a very large impact. And so it was really funny because about within like a week or two of thinking about that and talking to a couple people about it, I actually ran across a Twitter account of another guy, and I think I was like the second person to find his account, and he was trying to start something up like that himself. And so I reached out to him and I said, hey, is there any way I can help out? Is there any way I can get involved? And right away he kind of got me going, plugged in and everything, and started encouraging me to use Photoshop and learn the other skills that I would need to learn and help organize for it and everything. And slowly but surely, I just found myself having an increasingly active role in the organization. And it got to the point where originally National Youth Front was not a you know, specifically, it was more of a populist and civic nationalist organization than anything, though it was very pro-European, and the gentleman I was running with was very much aware that, you know, the issues that people of European heritage are facing with just the massive immigration and the racial replacement of our people. And so he was very sympathetic to it. And but there were some issues there as well on his side, because he was married to a woman of Hispanic heritage, and so he had decided to run it as kind of a civic nationalist thing. And after a little while, many of the members kind of grew unhappy with that and felt that it should be more explicitly pro-white. And many of the people who had signed up hadn't known. We hadn't tried to hide it from anyone or anything like that, but many people, this other gentleman had gone on nationalist, ethnic nationalist shows and promoted the organization. I told him it probably wasn't the best idea. because I think he just wasn't really aware of what he was getting himself into.
Right.
And I was just trying to be flexible and work with people. And I'm always trying to be flexible and work with people. What we're doing, what we're advocating for, this isn't about being negative towards other people, people of color and stuff like that. This is about finding a way for us to have a future for our own people. So at a certain point, he decided it would be best to step down, and he went ahead and let me kind of take it over. But at that point, I wasn't really ready for that, for the more public role. And I had actually been talking to Angelo John Gage for a little while at that point, and I asked him, since he was already public and whatnot, if he would be interested coming in and helping us lead it up. And so we had successes with that organization, though in many ways it's different from the one we have now, which is Identity Europa, which is, I want to stress, it's something actually very new and very different in a way from what National Youth Front was. And National Youth Front was almost like a training ground for many people, like Angelo and me, to kind of get our feet wet and gain a little bit of experience in organizing and understanding how everything works. And it was something that I would definitely do again. I think there were some great things that came out of that. We learned, I personally learned how to do a lot of coordinating and, Photoshop and all that other stuff. But there was something I feel that was kind of lacking, which was like this finesse that we seem to be missing with it. And but we did have some big successes. One of the big ones was Arizona State University. They started a class called The Problems of Whiteness, in which it's really this theory that, just basically by existing as a person of European heritage, you are essentially, your existence is repressive to other people's, people of color specifically, and that basically people of European heritage need to, like, step aside and just let other people, basically just, like, take over our society or something. So it's a very strange thing. It kind of came out of cultural Marxism and critical race theory, which if you ever study into, it's very it's almost promotes, like, I think sociopathy, if that's mm-hmm. the correct word. And it's, like, all about your personal experiences as an oppressed person of color or something like that.
Right.
So, like, you know, people of European heritage apparently, like, can't have an opinion on stuff, and it gets very strange. And there's really no literature in the class. They were using four books of this critical race theory, but they weren't presenting anything else in the class from any other point of view. They weren't presenting race realism or other possible theories for reasons of demographic inequality. And so we felt that that was something really that, was simply anti-white. When you're, it was basically indoctrination. Myself, I'm pretty big on freedom of speech, obviously. It's given us the ability to overcome a number of issues we've dealt with in the past with our society. But right now in the school system, what they have is really just indoctrination. They're not really challenging the students to really think about things. They're basically just telling them what to think. And so we had an issue with that, and what we managed to do was we actually made up some posters and stuff, and with the actual professor who had started the class, and we superimposed the word anti-white on his face and just put him up around the campus and stuff. And it had a big impact. It really that's hard to argue against. That's a message that's very hard to spin. And so that actually managed to get a bit of media attention and really got some buzz around campus. And some of our local guys down there did a really good job. There was at one point a gentleman who was, I think, working underneath that professor as an instructor who decided to have, like, just kind of in the quad, almost the same thing we did at UC Berkeley, which was he just decided to go out on the quad and talk to students about the class.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our guys went down there and kind of baited him into saying some pretty bad things he shouldn't have said. And the guy's opinion was basically like any person of European heritage who tried to organize for their own interests or whatnot was essentially a racist. And so then he said, you know, what should we do with racists then? And he said, well, you know, do you think we should suppress them violently? And the guy actually kind of like pumped up his chest and went ahead and said, oh, yeah, I think he's like, I don't care what they're doing if they're in their own household. But once they start to organize, I think we should use violence against them.
Right.
And so we kind of floated that out on the Internet. And I guess we had some guys who were actually like in some of the local Antifa social networks and like knew what they were saying back and forth. And apparently our intelligence gathering actually told us that some of the big financiers of the college actually found out about that and were not happy at all. And so they took the guy's name off the website and everything for a while and reviewed the whole case. I think he's still working there, but they really did some damage control. And so I think that was pretty powerful, as well as it helped us, you know, really put our name out there the same way that this Berkeley event did with Identity Europa. And it got a lot of new members for us and really got the ball rolling on things. And we did some similar stuff like that at a number of other colleges that was pretty successful. I think we even made it into USA Today at one point. And so, I mean, anytime you can get your name dropped or even, just our own terminology at that point, we were still really working on seeding the meme anti-white. And I think that one's just completely seeded now. In fact, when we were at Berkeley, the guys there were just terrified of that word. Anytime they started going down a path of logic that led to a world without people of European heritage, I'd be like, well, that's anti-white. And they're like, whoa, don't label me that. You know, don't call me that. I don't like that. So they were very much afraid of that word. And I think it's been well seeded. And I think, I really see this thing too, that they're with the word like racist and stuff like that. I think they're really afraid to use that now because they realize it's very ineffective now and it's been completely overused. And the few people that were using that while I was there, I just turned around and told them that that word was anti-white hate speech and used to undermine legitimate European interests, and they really didn't have anything to say. So I think that we've really figured out a message that works very well through all this, and I think we did a lot of good things with National Youth Front. Unfortunately, because it was the first organization we'd ever really, that I'd ever really worked with. There were some things, obviously, I didn't set the organization up, and so there were some issues with the name. I guess there was another organization out there that had a very similar name that felt that we were infringing on their copyright. So we just decided that it would be best to kind of scuttle it. We still had all the infrastructure and stuff like that, and we felt it was a really good time to launch something new. In fact, almost within months of Angelo stepping up and taking over, he was constantly talking to me about the need of other people other than himself to step up and become public figures. And he was constantly encouraging me to do that. And so when all that happened and we kind of realized that there were some issues with the name and stuff, we decided it would just be the best time for me to kind of come out and do that. And I think there's something really powerful in that, because the more of us start popping out, I think the more people, feel that this is real, this is a real movement, this is actually happening, and it's something they want to be part of. So I think it's something that's worked very well. Angelo went ahead, and he's now working with Resurgence Media and doing excellent things over there. And
how long was it around, by the way, in National Youth Front? How many years?
Perhaps about a year. I would say about a year or so. And I think at that time we just really begun to get the ball moving, and we've gotten the attention of obviously the ADL and the SPLC and stuff like that, which is, I think, why this other group kind of figured out that our name was similar to theirs and decided that, we don't really want to infringe upon any other organization either with what we're doing. And we understand that what we're doing is, in the times that we're living in, very politically incorrect.
Yeah.
And so we don't want to put other organizations at risk and stuff like that. So we just decided we'd scuttle the thing and start fresh and start new. And I think it's gone really well.
Yeah, very good. I mean, definitely later we want to talk a bit more about the, kind of the future and what you guys have planned and where this is going, basically, and some of the activism that you've been involved in. But I guess you have a background in military, right? So you kind of had a lot of things in common with Angelo, maybe. That's why you guys hit it off.
Yeah, I think so. Me and him were both in the Marine Corps. We're both Iraqi combat veterans. And I think that was part of it. When I first met him, I had seen some of his videos on YouTube, and I left a comment in the comment section, and he actually replied to me, which really surprised me. And after that, we kind of just really hit it off. I did two tours in Iraq, Al-Anbar province, which is now all basically ISIS-controlled. And it was interesting experience that really for a little while took a really heavy toll on me. I had some issues when I came back that I was dealing with. I lost several friends out there, and I took that really heavily. I also saw a little bit of combat, and that was a struggle for me for a while. And so that was a major part of my life that really I think is what led to me and Angelo getting along pretty well and hitting it off.
Yeah, definitely. Were you ever awake to the, I mean, was that much later you got into maybe studying the reasons for the war and all that stuff and what you've been part of? I know Angelo spoke quite a bit about that too. What about you? What's your journey like?
Yeah, it was probably years after I got out. It was probably 3 or 4 years initially, and I mentioned this on Greg Johnson's show, for those who haven't heard it, when I was on Countercurrents Radio. After my second tour, when I came back, I was dealing with a lot of issues, and I ended up incarcerated for a couple years because I had a flashback. I assaulted a man and unfortunately took some of his stuff. It's something I'm not proud of, but it's something that's there. It's in my history. But it was at that point in my life where I really started to look around and look for answers and try to figure out, what life was about. You know, why had we gone to Iraq was a big one for me, because when I was young, I was raised raised in a very patriotic family. Flag waving, conservative, like a lot of people still out there, unfortunately. So I really fell for, a lot of the bait and didn't really logically work through some of the issues with why we had gone over there. And I just wanted to do my part and do the right thing. But I started to reflect a lot on that and think to myself, we went out there and these people kept telling us, before there was one Hitler, now there's like thousands. They were basically discussing, all the different terrorists running around and stuff like that, and all the, fighting that it had caused throughout the country. And so it was a couple years after that, and it was while I was incarcerated that I began doing a lot of reading. You can see the books behind me. I sent them all home after I was done with them. And it was then that I really started looking for answers about what had happened, and that kind of led me down this rabbit hole of one thing to another, and eventually went from, I think there was a little bit of a religious identity crisis at the time as well. I was raised in a very fundamentalist Baptist home, and I was starting to kind of fall out with the Christian faith. And I was looking for answers elsewhere, and I think one of the places I first started looking was into evolution. I want to see if what I've been taught about it growing up was actually correct, if it contradicted what I had been taught. And so I kind of started reading into a little bit like of Richard Dawkins and stuff like that. And from there, my mind automatically began wandering onto human biological and genetic diversity. And it was something that was almost so simple that I was kind of surprised that I had never really thought about before. And from there, it kind of led me to, I think, one of the major books that really got me started was David Duke's My Awakening. And I think from there, the rest was really history. There's so many sources in there. It still took me a while. I had to go through and track down everything. I mean, I just didn't want to take his word for it. I mean, it sounded so logical, but I wanted to make sure that I was really on solid ground and that if these were facts, that they really checked out. So what I started doing was I actually started tracking down all the sources in the book on both sides of the issues, which he does a really good job at presenting. And I think it was I really spent probably about 3-4 years reading for about 10 hours, 12 hours a day. And I think that's really what did it. But it was pretty early on. It was within, I think, the first 6 months of me doing that I stumbled across much of this and began to become very red-pilled on many of the issues.
Wow. So how many years have you been into this now then?
I would have to say probably about 6 or 7 now.
Right.
So yeah. Slightly ahead of the curve in a way, because I know we've had this major wave over the last like 2 years.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, it was a lot different than most people, I guess, because most people coming into this have read like Steve Saylor and a number of other people through the years and have picked up on this through internet memes and then, you know, followed one website to the next. And I was just kind of following one book to the next. So, yeah, about 6 years, I'd say.
Oh, interesting. So let's talk a bit about what happened to Berkeley here and the event that kind of was it you and Richard kind of just want to collaborate on something and pull that together, or whose idea was it?
Yeah, it was I would have to say it's more Richard's than mine. I actually we were having a private event, and I had asked him if he might be interested in speaking at my school, and we were trying to kind of figure out what might get the greatest response. And I wasn't even sure if it would necessarily, after talking about a little bit with him, we weren't sure if it would be at my school. And yeah, who knows, perhaps that might be something in the future that we can try as well. We do want to engage the public. We do want to educate them. It's also really good to get some publicity from time to time, because you can reach so many people when you can get the media to cover things for you and spread things to their audience who may not necessarily be very internet savvy or something like that. So we're trying to find something that might work, and it was kind of really an experiment to see if we would gain media attention doing it, if these local Antifa groups would come out and try to stop us. And so it was really just an experiment to see what would happen if we did this. I would really like a chance to perhaps even review some of that with him later on down the road and see what his thoughts on it. But I don't think it really garnered the media attention. We were hoping it might.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there were definitely other aspects about what we did that were really powerful, that really worked in a way, and that are much more subtle. One of the things we really managed to do was, I think there were a lot of the local Antifa groups here who are really just shook up over this whole thing. In fact, one of the articles, they were basically suggesting using physical force against us or violence against us if we came back in the future. And I'm kind of looking into that to see whether or not I should be pressing charges or something, because that's very aggressive. That's not something anybody should be advocating, nor would it be anything we would ever advocate. So
right.
I'm not sure why they would want to meet us with force when we're trying to have a conversation. But it does also show that many of these people are very anti-dialogical. They don't want to have a conversation. And the only reason they say they want to have a conversation is because they think no one's really going to bring up talking points that refute what they're saying, and facts and whatnot that just show that what they're saying doesn't make any logical sense. So that's why I think recently, over the last like 5 years or so, you've heard this like massive call for having conversations about race on college campus.
Yeah.
Because no one's really educated, none of the students are educated enough to really take on these professors, and the ones that are educated are really just terrified of the social ostracism they will receive if they try to take on some of their professors or try to say these things publicly. So, you know, I think that there was a lot that came out of this, from the sense that I think one thing, we emboldened a lot of people and showed that it could be done. We could engage the public, and that for the most part, the public's not going to horribly freak out on you. I mean, there was one or two people that showed up and kind of, you know, started yelling anti-white pejoratives and epithets and things like that. But
it was pretty calm. I was a bit surprised by that, actually, to be honest, that it was so calm.
And that's something like I've had a lot of experience with, because I've delved into some of these topics at my own school and stuff in front of people. And while people get like really awkward about it, they usually don't like freak out. So
right.
It's actually something that I think I would like to continue doing in the future. I think it will be very successful. Just, other campus organizations do that. And I think that this is something we can do and be successful at, and continue to really challenge the narrative that's there on college campuses. I also think it was good because you guys got a chance to try to work out your new studio and
that's
everything.
True.
I think that was pretty awesome.
A crash course right there, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, so, it's a great idea, Nathan, I mean, of taking it out in reality and get away from the screens and the avatars and everything else. Another time, next time, when we have a bit more time, we could definitely plan it out. We could stream it a bit better, because we did miss a couple of things that you did. It would have been great to, for example, have your, when you kind of kick things off, if you will, that kind of started to get the wheels turning a little bit. It would have been great to get that in there. But as you know, we were kind of struggling with the connection. But great initiative, you know.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to give you the heads up next time. I had no clue that you guys were working on stuff like this. So, when I heard about that you guys were, I think one of you guys reached out to me perhaps a day or so before word
was
leaked
Lana.
To
yeah.
you guys.
Yep.
You guys got tentacles everywhere. So, I would love to let you guys know when we're doing this in the future and give you guys a little bit more prep time. And it would be great if you guys could cover stuff like that again, because I think we're entering this new. It's strange. The internet's changed everything, and we're going to have to put pressure on these institutions from outside to change. It's not going to be something I don't think we're going to be able to do from inside. At the same time, I think that if enough pressure and support is put out there, I think that some of these professors who are aware of this stuff will become emboldened themselves and will come out and start to speak. If they see that they've got a base of support to have the conversation. So that's one of the reasons why I would love to continue to do something like this. I've actually had, especially with one of my professors, we had a big disagreement in class, and he kind of flipped out, and then he asked to talk to me after class. And we sat there and talked, and after talking and after him realizing that I was much better educated on the issues than he realized, he basically kind of started saying, like, kind of trying to squirm out of what he had said in class, and was like, well, I have like a moral obligation to go with, you know, this this path. So it was really just more like he basically felt like it was the sociable, morally correct thing to do somehow.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of these professors that actually know what they're teaching is wrong, but they, a lot of times they just avoid conversations that will lead talking about.
Well, look, you know, during the live thing, we kind of, we played one of those examples at Yale, you know, which is a pretty good example of all these students gathering around this one teacher and basically like shouting him down, you know? And I mean, he must realize at some point there, like I've helped to create a monster, which is just going to devour everything in its way, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. These professors have put themselves in a corner, really, and they've advocated for things that weren't really in alignment with reality. Diversity really creates a very specifically, you know, ethnic and racial diversity, as well as religious and other types of differences that can be brought about through these policies of massive immigration, really just create these scenarios, especially because we have this this philosophy or this culture of I would almost call it equality fetishism or
right.
You know, equalness. And when there's such a focus on that, but you've got such disparate groups that you're trying to make equal, I mean, it's impossible.
It is impossible
to make these groups equal, and yeah. It's kind of ridiculous too. There really is this cognitive dissonance in which these people are saying, well, we're all diverse, but we're all the same. And so they've really just, because they've been advocating things that weren't in alignment with reality, now it's kind of the chickens come home to roost, and that, you know, they're not really, they're looking for a way out. They're in the corner and they're looking for a way out. And we need to be that group there to give them, you know, to reach out our hand and say, look, there's a way out, you know, but we need you to speak up for us. We can provide you with a base of support, but we need you to speak for us, because you're the one in that position. You're the tenured professor. So, I think that is one way in which we can move forward, and I think in the future, it's very realistic that 3, 4, 5 years from now, we may start seeing professors step out and start, you know, teaching these things.
I think so. What, let me ask you, because, I mean, obviously the left, they did the long march through the institutions, and they had a lot of, I don't know if they were young necessarily, but they did have a lot of, people getting into the university environment and slowly working themselves upward or forward, if you will. I'm wondering if something similar would be possible. Maybe if people were keeping themselves under the radar or something. I mean, it's a difficult question because they seem much more vehement and vigilant, I guess, than maybe at the time in the 50s and 60s those professors were, because obviously they had no idea that they were being infiltrated, more or less, I think.
Yeah. That's an interesting conversation in and of itself. I do have some family members who actually work in academia, and some of which are these very left-wing individuals in which we're challenging. I hate to almost say left-wing, but cultural Marxist. And, there are people in academia who know what's going on. I've had some of them actually reach out to me and say, thank you for what you're doing. I just feel like as a professor, I will have no support from my peers to speak out and say this stuff. And I feel like I'll be forced into early retirement
or
something like that.
Yeah.
So, they are there. They are there. And I think in a way the long march would almost be too slow. By the time we took them over through a long march, it'd be over.
Yeah, it's true. 20, yeah. It's more urgent now than that, you know?
And, I mean, that was actually originally, like, my thoughts. I was like, well, you know what, I'll just get my degrees and then I'll go into academia and I'll just keep quiet about things. But at a certain point, I just began realizing that by the time I even did that, it wasn't going to be realistic. It would probably be, you know, 20 years from now. And I would just be one person, so I figured I could have a much larger impact. And now, again, with the internet, we've got our own platforms and we can challenge these people. And that's another thing, is for the first time, there are platforms in which millions of people are being reached. And, now these professors have to compete with us.
That's true.
And so that's going to put an extreme amount of pressure on them to start really, reevaluating what they're doing.
So you think it's the students? We should target the students? I mean, obviously, that's what you guys are doing.
Yeah, definitely.
You're speaking to the younger crowd.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing. I mean, we're already trying to gain as much name recognition as possible among students. We're putting promo cards up around colleges across the country. I think that's a first major step for us is gaining name recognition. Within like 3 to 5 years, I would love for our organization to almost just be a household name. And there's a power with that. There's a reason why big corporations spend billions of dollars, trillions collectively, trying to get their name out there so everybody knows exactly who they are. And that will gain us a lot of power because right now I think there's a lot of people who are ready. I think there are tens of thousands of young individuals ready for our message who just don't know where to look. Even when I first started getting online 2 years ago, I had a very hard time. It took me about 6 months of really hardcore looking to find good websites and stuff like that were promoting pro-white ideas. So, and that's even with the knowledge I already had about these issues. So I think it's just really just a matter of gaining a lot of name recognition, letting people know we're out there, and showing people that this is something that's not somebody who's living out in the woods, doing hokey stuff. This is real people who are intelligent, who know what they're talking about. This isn't some hate group or something like that. This is a group of individuals who are truly concerned about the future of their people, as well as just the future of Western civilization and how that affects the rest of the world. Because what we're doing to ourselves isn't really helpful to the rest of the world either. So, I think that by putting our faces out there, and again, that's a very hard thing to do because already we have people trying to track us down and stuff like that. And I don't recommend people do it without knowing that they've got a pretty good safety net or something like that.
And at the same time, of course, there is security in numbers. We have to say that. The more people do speak out and just drop the avatar and the fake name, the more difficult it will be to keep track on everybody. And there's thousands and thousands of people, you know.
We're already seeing that, I think, right now. I got on Twitter a couple years ago, and hardly anyone was still on it. It had been around for a while, but there weren't a lot of pro-white accounts that I was aware of at that time. And now they're just, you can't even count them. They're everywhere. And a lot of them are. I noticed a lot of people that actually are using their real, what appears to be their real name, at least their face. So I think that's really emboldened a lot of people to come out and continue to push. And I think at this point, kind of the floodgates are open and the cat's out of the bag. There's no going back. So while I would definitely warn people that there are some major risks in doing that, I think it's almost inevitable at this point that this becomes mainstream at some point in the next decade.
Oh, it is. It's going to happen. Considering the pressure that we are put under right now by the mainstream and the establishment, more and more people wake up again, we've talked about it before on the show, but Trump, is obviously a reflection of American politics and the pressure that, European Americans are under. Even though he might not be explicit on that, he's obviously channeling a discontent and a worry that I think many European Americans have. And the more this becomes really a rhetoric which is okay, a tone which is okay, to have this language to discuss these things, more and more people are going to begin to go in that direction, and they're going to dare to talk about these things. I think that's a huge thing in itself, of just kind of crossing that, the Rubicon.
Exactly,
of identity, you know.
Yeah, we've really just been pushed into a corner, and we've been given nowhere to escape. I think, had there been just like one single country where, that was founded by people of European heritage that said that, this is for our people, I think there would have been a white flight there of many of us, perhaps even I myself included. But this isn't just an American phenomenon. This is happening literally in every European nation in the world, with the exception of, thank goodness, Hungary. And, you know, big shout out to Victor Orvin there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's great. That was a huge victory for us. I see that, that victory for the Hungarian people is a victory for the rest of us and as a model for the rest of people of European heritage to show that it can be done. And definitely, that we just have to make sure that our voices are heard and continue to put constant pressure on those in power and to continue to build networks and to push back against this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's at the current you know, trends as things are, it's inevitable that it goes in this direction. And the more people, you know, as you said, are kind of pushed up against the wall, there really isn't anywhere else they can go. And so, to a weird kind of, in a weird kind of way, I'm thankful that our detractors and enemies are pushing as hard as they do, because nothing is waking up people faster than what they're doing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, Richard Spencer has mentioned this a number of times. It's not even so much us as it's people are being red-pilled by life.
Right.
And perhaps that was also a large extent of my own awakening, too. I grew up here in California. My ancestors actually, like, were among the founders of the state here. And it's, you know, I've been dispossessed. And it's been a feeling that I've always kind of had. I couldn't really vocalize it when I was younger. But it's, you know, I did feel like a stranger growing up. Not to say that the people of color who were friends of mine and many of them still are very good friends of mine, you know, it wasn't to say that I was ever treated bad by them or anything like that, but it was just, I really felt like I was in an alien land. And I think one of the first big things to really start to wake me up to a lot of you know, culture and race and things like that was when I got into the Marine Corps, and for the first time in my life, I was around just a lot of white people. And I noticed that they seemed to share a lot of my views on just about everything. I felt really comfortable always expressing myself and just being myself around them, whereas I might go to one of my friends' birthday parties or something like that, and everybody's speaking Tagalog. And I just, you know, I felt really out of place and really didn't feel comfortable expressing myself, even though no one was really being mean to me or you know, everybody was very friendly. It was just, it wasn't, you know, I didn't feel, you know, it just didn't feel natural or comfortable.
Of course.
And so I think that was like also a major point that kind of led me to where I am today.
Well, what would you say? I mean, we're going to take probably a break here in about 5, and I want to talk a bit more about, you know, your organization, how people can get involved, what you know, in what way you guys are reaching out to people, both in terms of membership and help and all those kinds of things. But before that, what would you say to some of these people that we're talking about, maybe if they are, you know, non-white people, or they're just simply of the left and they just don't understand where you're coming from, or what would you say to have them understand your position and what the core of that really is?
I think the first thing is just to listen and to try to not have a knee-jerk reaction to what we're saying, because we're really not threatening people. We're not trying to harm anyone. We're not trying to hurt anyone. We simply want to make sure that we have a future. We're not trying to dictate to other people what they do, and if people want to live in a multiracial society, that's fine by me. But we need to have a place for us in which we can express ourselves, we can be ourselves, in which our children will have a future, and where we can express ourselves. I very much see Western civilization as the collective expression of people of European heritage, and that's something that is, you know, there's so many things I almost can't even describe, but it's when I say expression of ourselves, I mean collectively, I mean genetically, I mean historically. It's just, it's something that's very deep, and I think it's something that's very meaningful. And, you know, I wouldn't want something like what's going on right now to people of European heritage. I wouldn't want that happening to any other race of people. And I know there's been some, you know, there have been some very, you know, horrible things that you know, our race has may have done in the past, you know, in different countries. I know there are bad things, and, you know, every group of people on the planet has, you know, somebody in their ancestry has, you know, partaken in something that probably wasn't good.
Of course.
And we haven't done anything, you know, so uniquely evil that we should just be completely replaced. So what we want to do is we just want to have this conversation, and we want to find a peaceful solution to making sure that people of European heritage have are able to preserve their heritage and are able to make collective decisions for themselves and are able to live in a society that reflects themselves.
Very good. Well, let's talk a bit more now about Identity Europa, the website, what you guys are seeking to do, maybe in the short term and then maybe the long term as well. We have a few minutes here. And if you do want to reach out to people, if they can help you guys out, is there, you know, any way that you want to try to gain more members here? Just give us the details on this.
We are right now. We're in the stage of network building. We're really trying to do something different and special. We are very exclusive. We are very picky with who we select. We are looking for individuals who are very good at speaking, very sociable individuals who represent us just, you know, with their presence. When people are like, oh, hey, that's John down the street, and he's also an Identity Europa member, I want, you know, people who just know that guy and just to hear our organization's name and then knowing that this gentleman or woman is a part of our organization, I want them to always have this picture of just an outstanding person. And so we are very selective in who we're looking for, and there's a reason for that, because unfortunately the human mind is not fully developed, and individuals often look for any means to dismiss logical information that they can. And so we need to use every psychological method we can to really, get people to listen to what we have to say. And so I would really encourage everyone to try to join. If you think that is something that you would want to be a part of, give it a shot. Apply. And right now we're really just trying to build networks. While we do go out and do some activism and engage the public and stuff like that, and that really helps get our name out and gain name recognition, we are primarily a fraternity, and there's a lot of power in that, and we can really manage to influence a lot of what happens in society through having this nationwide network and fraternity from which people who are accepted into the organization can reach out and connect with others who are highly skilled and capable of making things happen, basically the movers and shakers of society.
An elite force. They're kind of like the SS. No, I'm just joking. give us the website, Nathan, so people know where to go. And you guys are on Twitter. You're on Facebook, I believe, as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you run Identity Europa on Google, you're going to find us. You're going to find our website, our Twitter. It's Europa is usually spelled with a V instead of a U, but actually you're going to find it either way if you type it in on a Google search. We're on Twitter. We're on YouTube. You almost can't even miss it nowadays. It used to be in the past you had to give out a whole URL and everything, but run a Google search. You'll definitely find us.
All right, really good. Well, we'll just take a short break right here, Nathan, and then we'll pick up in the second segment. Much more to speak with you about in terms of the organization, where you guys are going, and of course what some of the more pressing points are that we should do right now in terms of activism and everything else. So, yeah, stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
When home is the lowest, through these fields of destruction. Baptisms of fire. I've witnessed your suffering as the battle raged on, and the weight of heaviness will bend in the fear of the Lord. You did not desert me, my brothers and I.
Around, ladies and gentlemen, the second hour is coming up next. We have another segment here with Nathan Damigo. If you want to hear and or see more, redicemembers.com is the website. This interview is available in video format for members. We have much more to discuss, and when we return, we'll continue to talk about identitarian activism in North America and what we can do to change the environment, both on the university level and for Europeans as a whole. So more coming up in the second here. Upcoming guests, we have Jason Giorgiani, we have Dr. Andrew Joyce, and Andrew Fraser. We also have a Radio 3-4 team coming up this Wednesday with Janice Fiamengo on anti-feminism. This one will also be available as a video for members, so definitely don't miss that one. All right, well, for now, we say thank you for listening, but again, then, we'll be right back here with the second segment right after a short break. We'll see you on the members' website.